Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, well, who knows what will have happened by the time you hear this show, as Donald Trump seems to think nothing goes better after evidence that you tried to strong-arm a country into digging up dirt on an opponent than evidence that you tried to strong-arm another country into digging up dirt on a political opponent. We're in uncharted water with Trump and impeachment, and part of what's exceptional is Trump's open threats to the whistleblower who brought forth the evidence of his phone call with Ukraine President Zelensky in the first place. What protections does that person have, and what are media's role and responsibility here? We'll talk with Dana Gold, Senior Counsel and Director of Education at Government Accountability Project. Also on the show, upwards of 80% of Americans support the net neutrality rules that a court just ruled the FCC was within bounds in eliminating. That fight is not ending, but it might be changing locales. We'll get the latest on net neutrality from the president of Free Press, Craig Aaron. And that's coming up, but first we'll take a quick look back at some recent press. Two people died in a hail of bullets last weekend in the Bronx. One, a plainclothes New York City police officer, Brian Mulkeen. The other, Antonio Williams, accused of wrestling with the cop and possessing a weapon. It turned out to be the second case this year of a fatal so-called friendly fire incident. But as Josmar Trujillo writes for Fair.org, the New York Times took its cue from law enforcement and shaped the narrative early around gang violence, impugning an entire neighborhood in the process. In the early hours of September 29th, reporters began to post on social media about a police response to a shooting at the Edenwald houses. Sources, almost assuredly unnamed police sources, told a Spectrum News New York One reporter that, quote, cops saw someone suspicious, approached him, and he opened fire on them, close quote. That was false. Then there were reports that Officer Mulkeen was possibly killed by his own gun in a struggle with Williams, Williams still described as the shooting suspect. Well, we now know that Williams didn't kill anyone. All of the guns that were fired belonged to police, not unlike a similar incident back in February. But as details emerged, the Times put its spotlight not on what happened, but where it happened. You see, Edenwald Houses, like most public housing developments in the city, has been deemed gang territory by the NYPD, despite criticism, including Trujillo's, about how loosely the police place that gang label on particularly black communities. Various Times headlines had the housing project in which the officer was killed struggling with gang violence, then scarred by gang violence, and finally scarred by gangs. Maybe those step-downs had something to do with the fact that Edenwald had zero murders this year and last year, and only one shooting in that span. But the message to readers remained that Edenwald was, quote, plagued by gang violence, despite military-style gang sweeps aimed at ending the bloodshed, close quote. The piece hangs on the fact that the 47th Precinct, a five-mile square area that includes Edenwald, has seen shootings go up from last year. But the piece doesn't explain if those shootings were gang-related or not, or whether Williams was in a gang. In a story that uses the word gang eight times. Reporters can apparently connect gangs to any violence as long as it happens in gang territory, which notably is a designation that only police get to make. As for military-style gang sweeps aimed at ending the bloodshed, a CUNY Law report revealed the devastating 2016 federal sweep mostly ensnared people not accused of violence, half of whom weren't even accused of being gang members. But calling that aimed at ending the bloodshed makes it sound like virtuous policing and prosecution. What the Times did was essentially put the Edenwald houses through a media perp walk by insinuating to its readers that not only was Edenwald infested by gang violence, but that it had something to do with Officer Mulkeen's death. Some will argue that police say journalism is unavoidable, though things like longtime New York Times police reporter Al Baker going to work as NYPD spokesperson. Don't suggest a culture trying too hard to avoid it. And research shows the effects of blurring the line between cops and media hits communities of color hardest. For the residents of Edenwald houses in the Bronx, the police killing police violence might be a prelude to, of all things, more policing, due in serious part to media's willingness to subsume thoughtful reporting to the racist gangland storyline. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. The New York Times stands by its decision to publish identifying details about the whistleblower at the center of Donald Trump's power-abusing call with the president of Ukraine. Trump's people already knew this stuff, was the paper's explanation for not doing more to protect the person Trump and his ilk are calling a spy and a traitor. Whistleblowers have a long and important history in this country in which journalists play a critical role, though recent history makes vividly clear that not all whistleblowers are treated the same. But that's not because we don't have guidance on best practices, if indeed our goal is to preserve the ability of people to bring to light information the public should know but is hidden from us. As Daniel Ellsberg was quoted recently, officials in any country want to keep their secrets. What defines a democracy is that they don't get to. Joining us now for more light on this is Dana Gold. She's senior counsel and director of education at Government Accountability Project, the veteran whistleblower protection and advocacy organization. She joins us by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Counterspin, Dana Gold.
Thanks, Janine.
Well, Trump and some others were out of the gate calling the figure at the center of this Ukraine scandal a so-called whistleblower, which suggests they do think there is such a thing, but this person isn't one. But the way the term is tossed around, you almost get a sense that it's just a subjective designation, or that it depends on how you feel about the information disclosed or the person disclosing it. How do you define whistleblower and distinguish it from other sorts of actions?
There are a couple ways to answer that, and I tend to land as a lawyer on the legal definition. One of my colleagues, for instance, Tom Devine, who you know, our legal director, would define whistleblowing as someone who exercises free speech rights to expose abuses of public trust, which is a pretty big definition. Under the law, which is a complicated patchwork, actually, of protections, but generally we think of whistleblowers, again, not always, but often as employees who have evidence that they reasonably believe evidences a violation of law, rule, or regulation, gross mismanagement, gross waste of funds, an abuse of authority, or a substantial and specific danger to public health and safety. And I think that definition really matters because it helps us identify what is and isn't a whistleblower. And I think for me, there are two big pieces rooted in the law. One, often we think of that person as an employee. That's usually how the legal protections work. And that is because employees are in the best position to see evidence of wrongdoing, to find out first on the ground. They're the best mechanisms for identifying problems, promoting compliance with the law, protecting the public interest, and so we want to empower them to be able to make disclosures. But the other piece is that they're not blowing the whistle on someone, you know, taking a pad of post-it notes. It's the threshold. What matters for a disclosure is high. It's something that is rooted in the law or is very significant to protecting the public interest. And so we look at the content of the disclosure to, I think, often decide whether or not something rises to a level of what would constitute whistleblowing.
Part of the not really a whistleblower line was the initial take from the Federalist and then to Trump, that this whistleblower didn't have firsthand information and that therefore it didn't rise to a certain standard within the intelligence community. Oh, and also that the rules had been hastily changed at the last minute so that firsthand evidence wasn't required. That got debunked pretty thoroughly, but I think it just pointed to what you're saying is that different spheres might have different standards of things that you might need to meet.
That's right. I mean, I guess that it was, for those of us who work in this field, it was pretty laughable, actually, right? I mean, it sounds good that he didn't have firsthand information, but the law has never required that standard. It's a reasonable belief standard, and you have to have evidence of the wrongdoing. But this whistleblower said, you know, I have firsthand as well as some other information. That's what the law requires. He could have just had other information as long as that information proved to be, you know, again, both credible and urgent, and that kind of triggers the process for investigating and then disclosing up the chain of how a disclosure is supposed to work. So it's interesting, though, because I think you're right. It feeds into that charge, which was specious, feeds into the mischaracterizations about what constitutes whistleblowing and what doesn't. But we obviously know that the information was certainly credible. We know that from the partial transcript that's been released of the phone call.
Exactly.
Right? I mean, just we see, obviously, the evidence is there. It far surpasses reasonable belief, as well as certainly meets what would be constitute an abuse of authority, violation of law, all of the magic standards of threshold of concern.
Let me ask you about the actual laws that do exist about whistleblowing itself, or about the way whistleblowers are to be treated. What do we have protecting those folks?
So it's very complicated. There's no one law that protects all whistleblowers or all employees who report concerns. There are big hunks of laws. So the Whistleblower Protection Act, which we've often heard referenced, but actually doesn't apply to this whistleblower, but the Whistleblower Protection Act, which was amended by the Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act in 2012, protects non-intelligence federal employees for reporting those kinds of concerns I mentioned. They have a right to make disclosures free from reprisal. The intelligence community have a different set of protections. They have what's called the Intelligence Community Whistleblower Protection Act, and there are various presidential directives and executive orders that are the implementing pieces of that law. But it's similar. They have the similar right to make disclosures, but the process by which they can make those disclosures is very prescribed and narrow because they're often working with classified information. So most federal employees are not dealing with classified information, but for those in the intelligence community who might be, they need to make disclosures through the inspector general. And then, of course, there are other employees who are whistleblowers, those in the corporate sector, those who are blowing the whistle on environmental issues or bank fraud, et cetera. And there's a patchwork of whistleblower protections around each of those laws. So partly what you're blowing the whistle on can matter in terms of what kind of protection you have. It can also matter what kind of employee you are. Sometimes it matters what kind of reprisal you've experienced. So it's very complicated, actually. It's why lawyers actually matter in this sphere.
Well, unsurprisingly, Donald Trump said in response to questions about whistleblower protections, "I don't care." He's been demanding to meet this person face to face. It feels unprecedented to have the president threatening the whistleblower. I mean, it's kind of witness tampering. This is kind of new territory, maybe.
It is. I mean, I think that it really shows some weaknesses in terms of the law, right? But I think often we're not envisioning the rot being at the top, you know, and that's how, you know, the accusation goes really all the way to the top here. So there are provisions in the law that protect the anonymity of the person making the disclosure, part to preserve the integrity of an investigation, and certainly in part to minimize reprisal. You know, we're kind of seeing the playbook mapped out for us, you know, quite beautifully and frighteningly, right? But it's like, you know, you attack the messenger, you know, you threaten them.
Yeah.
It just really becomes all about trying to focus on the messenger and not the message, to discredit, to deflect attention. And it also certainly creates a chilling effect on others who might think about speaking, supporting the whistleblower's disclosures, or coming forward on other issues.
Well, in this case, the whistleblower didn't go to media. They're going through the much vaunted proper channels. But the reason that some got so upset at newspapers publishing information about the whistleblower was concerns about retaliation and harm, first of all, but also because anonymity, like you've just said, anonymity, I think it's Jesslyn Raddick who just said, it helps strip away the tendency to shoot the messenger rather than listen to the message, that the anonymity is key to make the story what the story should be. You know, journalists love a story, but it's crucial that they don't focus on why whistleblowers come forward or their backstory, because the story has to be what's revealed.
I think That's all really true. You can understand, though, why, of course, in this competitive age of journalism, the story is made more colorful by the human interest of finding out about who the whistleblower is. I think you're right to point out the issue of, you know, what are the ethics here? What is the duty of journalists when they know that the degree of vulnerability that all whistleblowers experience, right? Not this one particularly, right? This is just a scale that is why we're all trained, like all the world's attention is trained on this story, right? And we all get that the risk of outing this whistleblower is high because of the rhetoric and the stakes, right? The rhetoric is intense and hostile, and the stakes are incredibly high. So we all understand in this very graphic way that there is real risk to this patriot who did the right thing, you know, did his duty of reporting wrongdoing and did it through proper channels. So we see that, but, you know, all employees are at risk of reprisal, actually. And so when you think about what the duty is, you know, on the part of journalists, I mean, the journalist's duty is to their reader. The hard thing here is that this whistleblower actually isn't a source. Right. The whistleblower made a disclosure to the IG and not to the journalist. So how do we think about what the duty is then on the part of journalists to protect the whistleblower who is actually not their source? But I think when we know that the risk to the whistleblower is, we're not talking about normal levels of reprisal here, right? We're talking about physical risk of harm, I think. And I don't think that's me being a conspiracy theorist, right, or a fabulist. I think that that is the rhetoric that we're hearing, that I think it puts a fine point on if journalists, for instance, want information to come forward, what does it mean to do responsible journalism, whether or not that person is actually a source for that journalist?
Yeah, and, you know, I wish media did more to protect whistleblowers even when they are their source.
Absolutely.
Daniel Ellsberg was a New York Times source for the Pentagon Papers, but they didn't help him with his criminal case. And in fact, Abe Rosenthal said the paper just had no policy for helping a source who was being prosecuted,
right?
You know, and certainly the way that media have reviled and ignored Chelsea Manning and Assange and Edward Snowden after using their work to win prizes, you know, I just think is perverse. I think journalists have a responsibility to just go on the record supporting folks who are in this position, you know, but particularly, as you say, the standards are different when they have actually been your source. But, you know, bigger picture for the country, a process that allows for people to get information out and not be retaliated against is crucial for a society with democratic aspirations, you know, and it seems like big picture, the U.S. seems to be sliding backward in that sphere.
Absolutely. I think that's why this case is so important on every level, and even to the role of journalists, right, in terms of making sure that the public has information that they need to be able to self-govern. This is just a microcosm of democracy in action and where it's working and where it's not. You know, in some ways, it is working. Again, the best source of accountability and making democracy work, you know, did their job, reported wrongdoing, did it up the chain, and then things got gummed up when the acting director of national intelligence failed to refer the complaint to Congress in this mandated 7-day period because of political interference. You know, so to me, I think this is such a concerning scenario, not just because of the explosive content that the whistleblower disclosed about the abuse of authority of pressuring a foreign interest to investigate a political rival and then to cover it up, right, the substance of the disclosure. But the political interference in the whistleblower disclosure process is horrifying, because if that's not working, right, Congress can't do its job of overseeing the executive branch. Information is going to dry up. We can't, as a country, engage in governance. But to me, that is actually the constitutional crisis that we're in. It's why we have to get this right, and why the role of the media is equally important, you know, as the fourth estate in keeping the information flowing.
Absolutely.
And how they treat that whistleblower now matters for how we think about the flow of information coming from employee sources in the future.
We've been speaking with Dana Gold. She's Senior Counsel and Director of Education at Government Accountability Project. You can find them online at whistleblower.org. Dana Gold, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you so much for having me and for all your good work.
A federal appeals court has ruled that it was okay for the FCC, over the overwhelming, openly stated will of millions of people, to classify internet service providers as information services, rather than what we understand them to be, telecommunications services, and thus allow them to avert rules about open and non-discriminatory access. It's a big loss, but it doesn't sound like the fight is over so much as maybe changing locale. Joining us now to catch us up is Craig Aaron, president of the group Free Press. He joins us by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome back to Counterspin, Craig Aaron.
Well, thanks so much for having me back.
Well, it would have been great for the court to push back against this Republican-led FCC ruling, which listeners will know went against the desires and demands of the vast majority of the public who commented. The agency went through all manner of shenanigans trying to distort that public comment and then just ignored it. But it also went against common sense and our knowledge about the role that the internet plays in our lives today. So the ruling stinks, I guess, is the first thing to say.
I'm certainly very disappointed in the outcome, but you can look at all 186 pages of this ruling. But what it all essentially boils down to is the court said, this is up to the FCC. They're the expert agency and we defer. And in this case, we defer no matter how misguided, ideologically motivated, or devoid of facts the FCC's approach was. It's ultimately up to them. The Supreme Court precedent backs them up. This was the high bar for challengers to clear. And the judges, while questioning how much the internet has changed, while going out of their way to talk about a number of areas where the FCC really lacked evidence or strong arguments, ultimately said, you're the expert agency, this court are not the experts, and we defer to you. Which, you know, somewhat ironically and not very satisfying, was the same reason that the previous FCC prevailed in making strong net neutrality rules. And when the industry challenged, they said, nope, it's up to the agency. So here we are again. And of course, that means a future FCC could step in to restore real net neutrality and actually get this right.
Yeah, and it really makes it a conversation about what space are we having this fight in and who's in charge of it. It was interesting, you know, usually industry and regulatory enablers like Ajit Pai say, you know, these public interest obligations are so old and dusty and everything's different now, you know. But in this case, the court said this ruling from 2005, this Brand X case, that just ties our hands. That was the way it was interpreted before. And so we have to look at it that way again this time as well.
That's certainly true. It can be a constantly moving time frame on what do we actually do. And of course, we're disappointed and we challenged these rules because this FCC so clearly ignored the evidence. They so clearly ignored the public will. They just simply clearly ignored the way the internet works in order to favor the biggest phone and cable companies. But that doesn't mean there aren't silver linings here. And one thing the court did do is they rejected the FCC's claims that they could overrule state legislation out of hand, that they could say the states had no place here. The courts did not agree. And so they've opened the door. A number of states, four states already, including California, have passed strong net neutrality laws. And now they're going to have a chance to defend those laws on an individual basis. And there's an opening to say, hey, if the federal government has abdicated the responsibility to protect the free and open internet, the states can step in. And so this is a fight that's going to move to the states. And this is also a fight that's going to move to Congress, because this really pushes Congress to act to restore what the FCC has taken away. The House of Representatives passed overwhelmingly this year a bill called the Save the Internet Act that would restore the 2015 FCC rules, clearly protect net neutrality. The Senate could vote on that. It's sitting right in front of them. Will they? Well, Mitch McConnell's still there, so I don't know. It's going to take a lot of public pressure. But whether it's this Congress or the next Congress, they have a chance to still get this right. The fight does continue. There are new openings. The FCC, in a number of areas, got things sent back to them. The courts noted another couple of areas where they barely scraped by. So this was not an overwhelming victory for the FCC,
right,
but it does leave their terrible decision in place. And we're going to have to fight really hard to undo that in the years ahead and in whoever's in power in 2021.
Well, let me just ask you quickly about the states. Former FCC Chair Tom Wheeler just had this op-ed in the New York Times in which he said internet service providers should be quaking in their boots. And the reason is now they're going to have to deal state by state with requirements about access. California already says, no, net neutrality is going to be the law in our state. You know, so it seems, and it's just what you're saying, we have to keep our eyes on both things. We want states to go forward, right? Even as we push for Congress to do something that would obviate the need for that, maybe.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. Because, when the FCC, when the referee who's supposed to be in the game says, well, we don't see anything anymore, someone's going to step in, and California already has. Obviously, if you're an internet company, an internet service provider, you have to pay attention to what California is doing. Obviously, if we were to have a bunch of different rules in a bunch of different places, that gets very complicated very quickly. But this, unfortunately, is a result of what the FCC decided to do. So I think you will see the companies be very nervous about that. I think you will see them try to push fake compromises through Congress, bad legislation written by them, tilting the scales in their favor. And that's going to be another thing we're going to have to fight against. But why I'm confident, why I'm, more determined than discouraged, is because the public is clearly on the side of net neutrality, clearly on the side of the free and open internet. And, 99.7% of the comments that went into the FCC that were original, that weren't cut and pasted or weren't made up, as the case may be, there's a lot of fraud, unfortunately, in that docket. 99% of those individual comments said they supported net neutrality. That reflects the will of the public. The hundreds of protests that have taken place in the last few years on this issue show where the public is. And I think the politicians and the policymakers will catch up. Unfortunately, on this decision, it's a little bit more of an uphill climb than it should be.
We've been speaking with Craig Aaron, president of Free Press. Find them online at freepress.net. Craig Aaron, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you for the time.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show's engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.